We get things underway by welcoming back to the show and back here in the studio, our friend Sean Latch from the Amera Astronomy Center at the University of Maine. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
And welcome back to America. You've been doing some international travel, huh?
Yeah, I got back a couple weeks ago. I was doing some travel over in France, working with the International Planetarium Society.
Well, you're not just working with them, but I mean, you're kind of running the show, right?
Yeah, well, last year and this year, I'm president of that organization, and so get to work with planetarium folks from around the globe and discuss a variety of astronomy education issues and things like that. So we had a big conference, about 600 people, 8 concurrent session, lots of guest speakers, and the whole nine yards.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Now you're back and in the midst of a very busy month of August, where the red planet is the focus.
Yeah, Mars, of course, just passed its closest approach to Earth back on the 31st of July. And every 2 years, Mars and Earth get close together. But this year, a special year, there's sort of between a 15 and 17 year cycle when they come really close together. Last time was in 2003. And so Mars has been really prominent in the southeastern sky as soon as it gets dark. And our monthly public program this month, of course, is called Mars 1001. It takes a look at humans going to Mars. The 1001 is the number of days it would take to send humans and have them return safely. So you're looking at a little over 3 years to go and return from the red planet.
And of course, there's been increased talk of potential plans of getting back to manned space travel and some different approaches to that. I know that I believe NASA is still planning on, they're calling it the Lunar Orbital Platform Gateway.
Yeah.
And the idea is that might be a jumping off spot for a trip to Mars. But I was reading something recently that said, you know, that's only that journey from here to Mars is only a few percentage points of the entire trip. It's not like it's at the halfway point or anything.
Oh, yeah. Going to the moon is easy. I mean, we can go to the moon, you know, when we went back between, you know, 1969, 1972, it was basically about a 3.5 day trip to get to the moon. Then they'd stay for, you know, anywhere from a few hours to a few days and then come back, you know, in 3 days back. Going to Mars, you're looking at, you know, around 7 to 9 months, depending on the particular journey. One way to get there, you're going to have to stay on the surface a year and a half before Earth and Mars line up correctly again to come back. And then again, that same amount of time back. So you're looking at around a little over 3 years to go and safely return from the red planet. So it's a long journey. So unlike going to the moon where you could just go and come back, we're going to have stuff sent in advance where folks can assemble a Mars base and be able to, you know, live and stay there for some time.
And also getting there, the rocket needed, the technology that got us to the moon, the Saturn V, that had its place. But is that practical to get us as far as Mars?
Yeah, I mean, we'd probably want to have something, you know, constructed in orbit and then have a rocket of that size give us a blast. You don't need a huge amount of thrust to get you going. And you know, basically because you're not fighting the effects once you're above, you know, Earth's atmosphere, you're not having to fight that escape gravity. So you can just, you know, use a small thrust, if you will, to get you going. And then, you know, gravity will do its thing. So we'll be using sort of a Holman transfer ellipse to get us there. But yeah, the technology used for going to the moon, we're going to need rockets like that to get stuff into orbit to build, you know, a space vehicle that can take us to Mars, more than likely.
And then, of course, there's the whole idea of what all that time off Earth does to the people involved, to the astronauts in terms of their body, but also their mind.
Yeah, I mean, we've had astronauts who have stayed on board the International Space Station for over a year. And we do know it can. I mean, they have to exercise for roughly 2 hours a day to keep them in physical shape because your bones and muscles will atrophy away, basically, because you don't have gravity to help you with that. So they have to, you know, use special machines to simulate gravity and things like that. There's been discussion, could we create artificial gravity on the way to Mars? We're probably still a long ways off from that. I mean, there might be some possibilities for it, but it is one of those things that's going to be complicated. So, yeah, that's one of the things you're going to want astronauts who have, you know, who can take that long trip and, you know, be willing to be away for quite some time. Because, again, you're looking at 3 years.
And we're still, obviously, a number of years from getting there. Mm-hmm. What will come first? Do you think we'll see some level of colonization of the moon before we make that Mars journey?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's been discussion of using the Mars as a place to train and prep for going, or using the Moon, excuse me, to train and prep for going to Mars. And I think that is a good possibility. But, you know, it's going to really come down to the investment. I mean, either way, if you're going to go to Mars, it's going to require a large investment. It really is going to have to be a multinational thing. I think it's pretty unrealistic to say that one nation is going to go to Mars on their own. You know, because again, the immense cost and resources required to do so, and even expertise. I think it's much better if you use an international mission to do that.
Does privatization make that likelihood more likely to happen? And what challenges do you get when you've got multinational organizations and governments working with entrepreneurs?
That is an interesting thing. I mean, we'll have to wait and see. You know, of course, Elon Musk has been already trying to, you know, get there, you might say, and we even have a Tesla that's sort of on its way. But, you know, it is one of those things. I think the good news about the private companies is that they are creating some competition. Right now, we really haven't had that space race like we used to back when it was the U.S. and the former Soviet Union. So, I mean, and, you know, China is coming up, but there still hasn't been that really competition, national competition. On the other hand, you know, we have done some things cooperatively, like the International Space Station, where we work with the Russians, we work with a variety of other nations to, you know, to have a station in space that does research and serves the global population in a variety of ways. So, I mean, hopefully, you know, the entrepreneurs will push development of technologies because they can do so at a faster rate and in some cases, you know, leapfrog the development of things. But I do think in terms of actually sending people there, I really do think it's going to have to be a multinational. It's going to be pretty difficult, again, because it's a huge amount of resources that you're going to have to put there, to be able to live and work there, like I said, for a year and a half.
When we started these cooperative efforts, though, like the International Space Station, is it accurate to say that more countries have gotten involved in exploration because they didn't need that huge infrastructure of building their own rockets, that they could have trained people and scientists available to go into space, but they didn't have to build their own rocket?
Right. And that's actually one of the issues that the U.S. has right now. I mean, since we retired the space shuttle, we're right now relying on other governments. Primarily,
we're
hitchhikers, but there is discussion right now, that both, of course, SpaceX and Boeing about, sending humans and doing some tests for sending humans to Mars or to the space station, on their new rockets. There's been discussion because they're already sending payload packages to ISS that are, unmanned. But the question is, can they start to get humans there? And I think once they do that, if that happens, then, there's a good chance that will spur, future developments for longer-term missions and in human missions. It is always an interplay between, having governments do it versus having private industry. There's advantages and disadvantages, right. To each. Hopefully, on the private side, they can make things happen faster. Sometimes, they're also willing to take more risks. Than sometimes governments are, and that's one thing I think that everyone needs to realize, when we do space exploration, it is a risky business. Overall, humans in space flight, we have been very lucky. We've only had, a relatively small amount of losses.
Right.
But this is a risky bit, it's something there, it's not fail safe. There are going to be losses, mm-hmm. but it's like anything. If every time you had a loss when we were first circumnavigating the globe, you said, "Well, we're just going to stop," then things never would have progressed. So I do think that people have to be aware that space exploration is a dangerous and risky business.
Well, it's hard to believe. It's been so long since we've been back. I mean, as somebody who was a kid and a huge fan of the space program. At the time of the Apollo missions, where it seemed like every time one would come back, another one was on its way. And now we're down to, we were talking about this recently, there are only 3 men left who've walked on the moon.
Yeah, I mean, well, next year, of course, is the 50th anniversary. Mm. So, when you look at that, I mean, yeah, everyone is sort of getting up there in terms of age. And I think folks did think that when we went to the moon that space travel would be, commonplace. But then after that, you know, we ramp back to doing basically, you know, orbital flights and, you know, with the space station and Skylab and things of that nature. And so we really haven't done the, you know, the long distance space flight. So the moon has been the farthest place we've been. It's 240,000 miles away. Again, Mars is, you know, several million miles away. So it's going to be a long trip to get there. And a different way of doing things.
You can learn more about it at Amera Astronomy Center's Mars 1001 Friday night at 7 o'clock. You've also got some other great programs going on Sundays at 2 o'clock in my backyard.
Yeah, that's a program for very young children. It takes a look at things you'd see in your backyard, including things in the sky. Talks a little bit about day and night and a little bit of you know, the moon and things that kids can expect to see in the sky. And then during the summer months, we have special programming on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Friday afternoons. And we rotate a variety of different topics. So next week, Tuesday, we have Polaris, where you join a penguin and a polar bear, and you learn a little bit about ice in the solar system and the reason polar night is very long. Then Thursday, we have Dream to Fly, which takes a look at the history of flight. From, you know, hot air balloons all the way through modern aviation. And that actually features a portion of discussion on the Bangor Regional Airport. We worked with them when we brought the program first in a little over a year ago. And, you know, we talk about some of the things that how they're connected to the history of flight and what's and they just had their 50th anniversary. There was a big thing in the paper today about that. And they're celebrating 50 years there. And Amelia, one of the big things I always was amazed at is Amelia Earhart flew from Bangor to Boston.
Yes.
And, you know, and that was really amazing when you think of that history. And then Friday at 2, we have a show called We Are Astronomers that take a look at the tools astronomers use and how modern astronomy is done. It's not someone just looking through a telescope with their eye to the eyepiece anymore, like, you know, one thinks of it. But it looks at all the different technologies astronomers are using, from things like the Super Collider at CERN to space-based telescopes to a whole variety of other instrumentation to explore the universe that we live in.
When it comes to research that's in progress right now, from your perspective, what's the most exciting thing that our scientists and researchers are working on?
I really, you know, there's a couple things I really am excited about. One, of course, is exoplanets, the planets beyond our own solar system, because we keep discovering more and the tools are getting better, where soon we'll be able to measure atmospheric composition of these worlds, which will give us another sort of tick closer to figuring out if there could be life elsewhere in our universe. So that's one of the really exciting pieces. I think the other side is sort of the large-scale stuff for me, which is the cosmology side in terms of galaxies and large-scale structure of the universe. And we keep trying to figure out the overall way the universe has evolved over time, and looking at these very large structures and the interaction of dark matter and dark energy in terms of moving our universe around, which is pretty incredible.
Well, it's fantastic and a great local resource. So we're so lucky to have the Amera Astronomy Center and the planetarium, of course, at the University of Maine. Sean, always great to talk with you. Thanks again for stopping in.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me.